national convention covering it. $20 million will go to the riot gear that they get to keep afterwards.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been on the ground in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and watched the militarization of our police departments. We've watched Baton Rouge. The Baton Rouge the Police Department has gotten $3 million from the Justice Department over the last 5 years, even while having multiple civil rights investigations. We continue to see the fact that we are not changing the incentive structure between federal government money and what local enforcement do. So we went to the White House because we continue to bring demands to the White House. And we're always willing to have conversation and dialogue. But more than conversation and dialogue, we need action. Because without action, we will continue to be in this place 5, 10, 15 years from now. So as we work to mobilize our members, I brought the concerns of our... And I also had a real back and forth with the head of Fraternal Order of Police, who unfortunately will continue to come to these conversations, but never offer up a demand.
We're going to find out what you said and post it online at democracynow.org. Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, thanks so much for being with us. That concludes our 2 hours of daily broadcast, the first day from the Republican National Convention here in Cleveland. Tune in every day and tell your friends. Special thanks to David Prude and Dennis Moynihan. Happy birthday to Laura Gottesdiener and Paul Huckabee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to KBOO Monday through Thursday from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. for special live convention coverage produced by the Pacifica News Network. Monday, July 18th through Thursday, July 21st, tune in to comprehensive progressive coverage of the Republican convention happening in Cleveland. Again, that's July 18th through the 21st, 5 to 9 p.m., for coverage from the Republican convention, produced by the Pacifica News Network here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Crop Up Dinner Series and Market Showcase. The Aurora Dinner will be held July 21st from 5:30 to 9 p.m. The dinner series lets you dine on dishes built around Oregon's specialty crops that are grown in the local regions surrounding each dinner site. It has been designed to increase awareness of the bountiful diversity of Oregon's specialty crops, including fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, and nursery crops. Again, that's the Crop Up Dinner Series and Market Showcase, July 21st from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at 15210 Northeast Miley Road in Aurora. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. Kicking off today's program, Lori Mercier interviews Herb Ruffin, Associate Professor of History and African-American Studies at Syracuse University. They'll be discussing a recent article that Ruffin wrote for the blackpast.org webpage entitled Black Lives Matter, The Growth of a New Social Justice Movement. Blackpast.org is an online reference guide to African-American history. Bill Resnick will be talking with Hallie Hawkins. Hawken is a perennial candidate for the New York State Green Party, but he's different because he is now getting over 5% in state elections and 35% in Syracuse, where the Democrats and Republicans joined forces to defeat him. Howard is well known in New York for his research and grasp of state policy. They'll be talking about energy policy and some local initiatives that have promise. Concluding our program today, Desiree Heligers continues her series on the Quinault Indian Nation protest against the siting of fossil fuels in Grays Harbor. Now here's Lori Mercier and Herb Ruffin.
Thanks, Tom. Herb Ruffin II is Associate Professor of Africana and Urban History and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Syracuse University. He is author of the book, Uninvited Neighbors, African Americans in the Silicon Valley, and the article, Black Lives Matter, The Growth of a New Social Justice Movement, featured on blackpast.org. Welcome to KABU, Herb.
Thank you, Laura.
Many people remember that the killing of Michael Brown by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 awakened a movement that began with the 2012 killing of another black teenager, Trayvon Martin, by Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman. Even though protests have not halted the killings of black people, and most recently, sadly, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, and the acquittals of their killers in the criminal justice system, the Black Lives Matter movement has reframed the way Americans think about police treatment of people of color. Herb Ruffin, let's talk briefly about the founding of Black Lives Matter and then come back to the focus of your article about the historical roots of this social and racial justice movement. First, tell us about the West Coast and social media origins of Black Lives Matter.
Oh, the West Coast and social media origins. Well, Black Lives Matter is very unique because you have, of the three founders, and Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, Opal Tamate, they all are from different cities, but in particular from cities out west. We're talking about Oakland, we're talking about Los Angeles, Phoenix. Garza in particular has a background as a domestic worker rights organizer in Oakland. Cullors, anti-police violence organizer in Los Angeles, and Tamate, and immigration rights organization organizer inside Phoenix. And they came together, they were, in particular, they came together through a community organizing leadership collective called Bold Black Organization Against Leadership and Dignity. And in particular, they came, well, when the Zimmerman trial, the acquittal took place inside 2013 during the summer, that's when you had this love note to black people from Garza. It went out, you know, basically calling for them to get active, organize, fight back, and to have, you know, basically the mainstream recognize that black lives actually do matter, you know.
Right.
But we have to look at this first and foremost. We have to start within our own communities and see what are some of the dysfunctions and going forward from there.
So Garza, Cullors, and Tometi were all community organizers long involved in the Black Liberation Movement, but they would not claim to start the more recent movement, but always mm-hmm. reference the long history since yeah. slavery of Black resistance, and also credit Ferguson organizers for creating the movement mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other racial and social justice movements since the 1960s in particular that have inspired Black Lives Matter?
Well, you have, everybody knows about the NAACP, but there's a difference between the headquarters versus people who are in the grassroots, on the ground, in the streets. The headquarters themselves, largely through the Legal Defense Fund, a lot of people associate that with Charles Hamilton Houston and his more noted protege in Thurgood Marshall. They had led for decades, going back to the 1930s, for decades trying to do away with segregation, do away with Jim Crow. And we know how that have turned out. You have the SCLC or the Southern Leadership or Southern Christian Leadership Coalition led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we know how that has sort of worked itself out. Before that, interesting enough, a lot of people don't know this, but you had also collective organizing, coalition organizing from people like the Brotherhood of Sleeper Car Porters, who are part of the, what they used to call the Big Three in the 1940s, and then the Big Six in the 1960s among the top six civil rights organizations, which also included the National Urban League. It included the Congress of Racial Equality, and they all had different type of bases, different emphasis, whether you're talking about young people who are on the ground trying to do it more in a direct action type of way. You have ministers led in terms of the SCLC. SNCC is another group that I have not brought up. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And think about somebody like James Farmer or somebody like a Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, more people know him as, and the Mississippi Freedom Summers, and then you would have a transition to Black Power from that. So Black Power comes out of the civil rights movement, pushed by people coming of age in a baby boom generation in the mid-1960s. So this is sort of like the genealogy of how these things work up. And then in the Black Power period, of course, you will have the addition of a second Black Panther movement, the first one being just strictly people who are 80% of their population in black in counties where African Americans are inside the large majority, in places like Mississippi, Sunflower, Mississippi County, as well as Alabama, you know, Lowndes County, Alabama. And because they had to put some sort of animal down, they put down a panther, which made a lot of sense. An animal that's not going to directly attack you aggressively, but if you back it into a corner, then out of self-defense, it's going to go forward like that. And you have the spread of that going out to California. And with that, you have the Black Panther movement. A lot of people know about that movement. There was also the US, you know, US African Lives, in terms of Alana Karinga's group. And there were other groups out there as well, tons of groups that all had their particular type of bases, very similar, who were pushing for very similar things. The main thing about these groups, though, as I bring them up, and one thing about the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, they were labor first organized. With that stated, all these groups that I mentioned were, for the most part, male driven. That's to say that they were what Black Lives Matter would say, that they, or somebody who's a feminist or somebody who has those sensibilities along that line, they would say that they were a heteropatriarchal-based group.
Right.
And the difference between that group and the group today is that through intersectionality, supposedly, or at least in theory, those boundaries have been broken down, so now you have a much more balanced collective type of leadership. The collective part of it still roots into what SNCC was attempting to try to do inside the 1960s, but now you have a much more woman, feminist, LGBT, and Q base.
And Garza, Colors, and Tometi are all Black queer women.
Yes.
who founded Black Lives Matter. But it is important to kind of think about those historical roots and how Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter has studied and borrowed and lived much mm-hmm. of the history and work of earlier groups like SNCC. And the ideas of intersectionality that were not just prompted by the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s, but also these earlier Black liberation movements and struggles. And you also mentioned the emphasis on labor, and economic justice is another feature of Black Lives yeah. Matter, not just focusing on police violence, but connecting that structural violence in the system to economic injustice.
Can I say something a little bit about that?
Yes.
Going back again to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, because I did not fully explain that, and somebody like A. Philip Randolph, iconic labor leader, one of the organizers or the architects of the March on Washington movement going back to the 1940s, and that 1963 moment, that March on Washington was listed as March on Freedom for freedom and jobs, or jobs and freedom. in that moment, there was a compromise that took place to get rid of the jobs part. It's important to note the connections as you have put out there, because when we talk about the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., where did he necessarily pass away at? He passed away, you know, trying to represent workers in the sanitation fields inside Tennessee, assassinated along that type of line. And he was also breaking from the civil rights movement a little bit, which was not assertive enough in its stance on dealing with the Vietnam War of that time period, in aligning with the directions that were happening within a Black Power movement, in which basically I like to call it an empowerment movement, that in which if you have your civil rights, which the bills are passed in the mid-1960s, and keep in mind with the West have always had this. So what the South is asking for, the West in places like the urban North have always been, they've always had their vote. In theory, they've always had access to public accommodations and whatnot. You know, what do you do with that, you know, when things structurally continue as they have always been in an unequal type of situation? And this is what had led to the Black Power movement forming the way it did. And it's not surprising that on the West Coast, they took the lead in creating some dynamic, unprecedented models that would also connect into the international realm of Pan-Africanism.
Well, as you write in your article, Herb Ruffin, the LGBTQ movement and feminist movements have also played a key role. Since we just have a couple of minutes, tell us why you think the movement has been so successful. Because despite structural conditions that sustain police violence and the continuation of a racist criminal justice system and economic injustice, Black Lives Matter chapters have been created in dozens of cities around the country and really transformed the way governments, college campuses, and online communities consider the legacies of white supremacy and white privilege. So what do you think accounts for the movement's success?
Well, I'll say this. It's an international movement because there's Black Lives Matter all over. You're talking about when they initially came on board, a call for an end to violence. And you would have thought that with, you know, say for example, the passage of a Death in Custody Act or the U.S. Department of Justice investigating various cities and the police murders, or, you know, getting involved in like the presidential campaigns, not just trying to get the people within who are running for office to be accountable for Black lives actually mattering. You know, if their lives matter, you know, the statement goes, the people who are furthest on the bottom, then we're talking about even a much more balance in terms of that all lives matter that everybody wants. But that all lives matter is a call that is similar along the lines of saying we're inside a colorblind-based society, in which that's not necessarily the case.
Herb Ruffin, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave now, but I want to remind listeners of your terrific article, Black Lives Matter, The Growth of a New Social Justice Movement, featured on blackpast.org, and also your excellent book, Uninvited Neighbors, African Americans in the Silicon Valley. Thanks so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Okay. Yes.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon. Formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisited us. True and living.
That was called Glory by Common and John Legend. And this is the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now we go to Bill Resnick talking with Howie Hawkins of the New York State Green Party about energy policy.
Howie Hawkins, welcome to KBOO.
It's good to be here.
Howie Hawkins is the face of the Green Party in New York State. He's a perennial candidate in New York, always on the ballot, always losing. But Howie's very different from vanity candidates. When he ran for the governor in New York, he saved the Green Party's ballot status. He's their best-known candidate in New York State, does well in state elections. But mostly he runs in Syracuse, a depressed, deindustrialized city in upstate New York. He runs for the city council and mayor, and his vote count keeps increasing. In Syracuse, it's Howie Hawkins and a lot of the people that have organized around him and that are doing wonderful work. They've built a real political movement. It only loses because the Republicans are almost defunct and they don't run candidates. Howie does so well because he's enormously well-informed on the policies that impact cities like Syracuse, including energy policy. Howie, New York State and the Cuomo administration, they're positioning themselves as national leaders in green energy and curbing or stopping climate change. Cuomo has created a really large planning apparatus and has pushed through a great deal of legislation in quite a few areas. Describe what they've done, though, and what's the reality?
Well, they've made gestures, and compared to most other states, except maybe California and Hawaii, it's the best pro-renewables program in the country. But given the climate crisis we face, it's totally inadequate. I think that's the big picture. There are little programs for solar. We have a pretty good net metering program, a small feed-in tariffs demonstration project on Long Island, a goal of 50% renewable electricity by 2030. And maybe I give an example there. You know, that sounds good. We're already halfway there because we have a lot of hydro from the dams on the St. Lawrence River between Lake Ontario and the St. Lawrence Seaway. And electricity is only 25% of the state's carbon footprint. So if you get to 50% renewables, you're at 12.5% of the reduction you need. But since we're already halfway there, it's really only a 6% reduction in the carbon footprint over the next 17 years to 2030. By contrast, our movement, the Green Party and a broader safe energy movement, is calling for 100% by 2030. And we actually got a bill passed in the New York State Assembly to do a feasibility study of that, a real feasibility study. We have a general study from Mark Jacobson at Stanford that it is technically and economically feasible to do that.
Yeah, that was very impressive. Jacobson is very proud of that study and uses it as a example of what he could do for other states, and they are doing it.
Unfortunately, they've pushed it back 20 years for political reasons. And, you know, our position, and we've told them, is you give the politicians 20 years and they're just going to drop it because that's after they're in office or, you know, that's somebody else's problem. 2030, he should have stayed with that, but now it's 2050 and it's called the Solutions Project. You can go online and look at what the mix of renewables would be and a lot of graphics. But the better thing is to go to the study that was published in Energy Policy, which is more detailed.
Yeah, the Solutions Project's online, and Oregon is, in fact, they did a study of Oregon. It's worth looking at. Was Cuomo influenced by that study? It may well be he was, but why have they not, in fact, recognizing that it would be possible to do it very quickly at relatively modest cost? They aren't doing it.
Well, our argument would be it would not be at cost. It would be to enormous benefit. Just the Jacobson study showed that it was like 2 million jobs to build out the clean energy infrastructure over the next, it was 15 years when we started talking about it. Well, it was 20 years when we started talking about it, because the original Jacobson study was 2009. It was a global study, 100% clean energy by 2030 globally. And then he broke it down to the United States. Then his first state study was New York, and we used that in when I ran for governor in 2014 in particular. So that's what we've been calling for, and instead the state energy plan that the Cuomo administration has come up with has this clean energy standard that I just described, 50% of renewable electricity by 2030, doesn't deal with the heating system. That's all natural gas and propane. That's fossil fuels. He doesn't touch that. In fact, we increase our dependence on natural gas because we're importing it. I mean, a tremendous movement here got a ban on fracking in New York State, but now we're fighting the pipelines and the gas storage facilities they want to use to make the state even more dependent on natural gas for electricity as well as heating and cooking. So that's one problem. Another problem is they are including in the clean energy standard nuclear power. And we have a lot of aging nukes that are scheduled to go offline by 2030, and the utility companies want to close them now because they're losing money, and instead Cuomo wants to subsidize them to the tune of up to $4.5 billion between now and 2030 to keep them up and running as so-called carbon-free energy sources. So there are a lot of problems with the clean energy plan.
Why doesn't that $4.5 billion go to school districts and residential homeowners and others, small companies, to set up distributed energy systems? They actually, in their plan, I was reading it, they talk about distributed energy, small-scale, multiple installations on microgrids that, in fact, organize communities and lead to great conservation. They, in their plan, in fact, they have a lot of quite far-seeing and visionary language.
Well, that's an example of what I'm talking about. He talks left but walks right on energy. $4.5 billion for nukes. I think it's $40 million for these distributed energy plants. Now, a billion is a thousand millions. So, you know, he's basically talking about 0.1% in distributed energy systems, what he's willing to put into nuclear plants.
I was looking at some of the programs. Some of them look fairly attractive. There's the New York Sun program that allegedly has received a $1 billion commitment by Cuomo and the charges on electric bills to develop solar power in the state. Did they get $1 billion, and how are they using it?
I think it's $1 billion over 10 years, so that's $100 million a year, if I remember the numbers right. You know, that's a good program as far as it goes. It just doesn't go far enough.
The New York Sun program. The Green Bank is also interesting. I want to go through these because it seems to me that if properly funded and really aggressively administered, many of those elements would be elements that would also be part of a green program. I think it's probably a good idea to go through some of them. What do you think about the Green Bank?
If it was a real public bank that bypassed Wall Street and all the fees and interest that they would collect, it would be good. But the Green Bank is basically public guarantees to loans off of Wall Street, including their fees and interest. So it raises the cost, and it's being administered by our so-called energy czar in New York State, Richard Kaufman, who comes from Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And he was Obama's administrator of DOE loans. And Obama had this all-the-above energy plan, which included fossils and nukes and everything. Now he's working for Cuomo, and they have a program they called Reforming the Energy Vision, which is focused on market-based support for distributed energy systems and renewables. But so it's basically gearing the whole transformation in a way that'll be profitable to the investors on Wall Street, and the Green Bank is another example of that. We're calling for a public energy system where financed publicly, the utilities are owned by the public, and we start with municipals. We have 54 of them in New York State, municipals and cooperatives. Towns and villages own their distribution system and can build generation, and some of them are doing that, and then federate them from the local level to the state level. So the detailed planning of the renewable energy transition will be done in each local area, and the state would coordinate the research and development, the allocation of big resources, regional resources for use by the local utilities, and you know, coordinate the whole plan. So we'd have boards elected locally, and then those local boards would set up a state board. We have a New York Power Authority, which you know has both these hydro dams I mentioned, also a couple nuclear plants that are getting ready to shut down. So that we can put that all under the New York Power Authority.
This is KBLU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Howie Hawkins, Green Party leader in New York, lives in Syracuse, has run for office quite a few times in Syracuse. We've been talking about energy policy and state energy policy. Howie, let's talk about a few of the other programs that the Cuomo administration has set up. It seems to me that some of them actually are pretty good, and then we'll get to that. I mean, they could be useful if in a different package. They're also doing community solar, interestingly enough, where people who live in multiple dwellings can sort of pool money and invest in clean energy. I think that's sort of an interesting concept. But the question then becomes, why are they so slow? They're doing a pilot project in Long Island, is it, on feed-in tariffs. But it seems to me much more is needed. And the big utilities have a tremendous amount of power in choosing those producers of electricity that they want to in their system?
Well, actually, it's not the utilities. It's the power producers who are dependent on Wall Street financing. We had so-called deregulation, which was really restructuring and subsidizing some losers so they could get out with their shirts. So we have a separation of the utilities, which transmit and distribute the electricity and the natural gas. And
In New York, the investor-owned utilities have already been separated from all production.
Right.
That's also true in their plan. They really are subsidizing. I mean, they have big subsidies for sort of corporate electricity producers. Nothing like that for smaller ones, for school districts, for any of the kinds of things that can unite communities.
In terms of subsidies, that's mostly true. There's a small program for, as we talked about, for distributed energy microgrids, but it's really small scale. And my city hasn't even discussed trying to get some of that money. We got bigger problems. We got water mains breaking at a rate of more than one a day, streets caving in. It's an antiquated infrastructure over 120, 30 years old that needs to be replaced. And the governor came here and said, grow your economy and fix your own pipes. And we were talking billions of dollars in a city that has an operating budget of about $300 million a year.
Cuomo tells New York City that, too, even though New York City gives them most of their tax money. In fact, they have allegedly a big electrification of transportation, but they're basically impoverishing the New York City subway system. There seems to be a pattern in that, in what Cuomo's doing, which is sort of corporate welfare and reliance on the private interests who are allegedly somehow more efficient, which of course they aren't, and Goldman Sachs. It seems to me that some of the things they're doing could create useful models for what will have to be done when it becomes clear that their planning fits into a system, a very hierarchical system, and is very profitable for the people on top. But in fact, it doesn't do nearly enough. And what it does is preserve very inefficient and polluting industries and firms. What do you see as the future? What do you see as the usable products of all the churning that's going on in New York?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, we have the examples of public power at the local level that can be scaled up. The feed-in tariffs on Long Island have been very successful. The first auction of 20-year contracts was at 22 cents a kilowatt hour. The second one was 17 cents because solar electricity costs are going down, so they didn't have to offer as much to get people to buy into it. That needs to be scaled up. Statewide, we have a good net metering program. It pays the retail rate up to 25 kilowatts per residence, and it's very complicated. You got to depend on whether you're a business or not, and whether it's wind or it's solar PV or whatever. But it's basically good. The only thing is, it's capped at up to 6% of a utility's electricity demand, and so you got to get in on that on a first come first serve basis. That could be scaled up. The New York Sun program that helps solar energy get online is another one that could be scaled up. Where we're at right now is the movement that stopped the fracking is now fighting fossil fuel infrastructure. We've got pipelines, and we've been pretty successful in obstructing the construction of the gas pipelines, some of which would have been for New York State. A lot of that was going through New York State to onto New England from the gas fracked in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and we've put a lot of roadblocks there. We got gas storage and salt mines near Seneca Lake, one of the Finger Lakes, that there's really a grassroots movement that all the towns, except the actual one it's located in, and the counties around the area, it's a lake that provides drinking water to 100,000 people around the lake. And these salt mines are geologically unstable, so you put the gas in there, and it could leak into the lake and ruin the water. So that's one of the big struggles. We successfully stopped the liquefied natural gas, LNG port, Port Ambrose off of Long Island, which is a great site for offshore wind. So now the fight is to get the state to do a public purchase agreement that would create the market for businesses to go out there and build the offshore wind. And in the Jacobson plan, offshore wind would provide 40% of New York State's electricity, particularly for New York City, which is in close proximity to that offshore, those offshore wind generators. So that's another thing we're fighting. The other big fight is on the clean energy standard, and that has to do with the fact, as I went over the numbers before, 50% by 2030 for electricity is inadequate if you want to lower the carbon footprint significantly. There's no efficiency in the standard. You get no credit for efficiency, which the utilities that distribute like, because they're paid by the amount of electricity and gas people use. And then there's the nuclear subsidy that the ratepayers would pay over the next 13 years that's in the clean energy standard. And we want nuclear power not to be called clean energy. So that's another big fight going on. There are public hearings and legislation being discussed around that. And probably the biggest thing that we want to keep pushing, we got the New York State Assembly to adopt this bill to plan the transition to 100% clean energy by 2030. And it didn't get through the Senate. Cuomo didn't give it support. But we're bringing that back, and that's what we need. And then that would direct all the planning going on by the state toward that goal and would change what is now in the right direction, but token to adequate to the challenge we face from the climate crisis.
Howie Hawkins, one final issue. The transition to a clean economy, of course, is going to be fraught with struggle. One thing we know for sure is that the Western sort of way of life, that is this high consumption, high energy use way of life that the U.S. has pioneered, it can't go on everywhere and it will exhaust the planet. Life is going to have to change. How does the Green Party see that creating of the culture, transition to clean energy? How can that be part of it?
Well, there are two things that your description brings to mind that we're engaged in. One is supporting local institutions that help rebuild civic life. And as you pointed out, for example, shared solar on a block gets everybody thinking about where their electricity actually comes from. Instead of some distant coal or gas or nuclear plant, it's right there on the block. And particularly young people, it makes the world comprehensible. Right now, a lot of young people as well as older people are just mystified in terms of how things work. So that's one example. I'm in a USDA certified food desert. The grocery stores left the city of Syracuse. In fact, there are none left in the city limits. You got to go out to the suburbs. So we've started a food co-op here and this is a mostly black community, and there's some black farmers in the area that most people in the city don't even know exist, but these guys bring their produce right into the store now. And that begins to get people thinking about what they're eating. And we got soul food chefs with their little restaurants coming in showing people how to do more healthy food. So that all creates community and a civic life, because the big problem we face on any political problem, whether it's energy or income inequality, is the population is atomized. What is our politics? It's organized around candidate organizations that are funded by investors that want favors from the government. Forget the formal party structures. I mean, Bernie Sanders can get all the rules changes he wants in the Democratic Party. It don't make no difference, because Clinton's got all her money from, you know, Wall Street and these other big funders, as do most of the Democrats in Congress. So that's where the real power is. And the people don't choose these candidates. They go to a primary. They've already been pre-selected by the investors in these various entrepreneurial candidate organizations. So the population is atomized. There's no local party chapter in the Democratic Party, for example, where you can go and talk about the merits of this or that candidate or this or that policy or what demands we want to make on the national platform or the state platform or even the city platform. What city platform? You don't have platforms, you know, in the major parties. You've got candidates, and they don't often run on policy. They run on, they grew up here and they got three nice kids and a dog, and that's the first thing we got to do. So that's on the building institutions. On the political side, you know, we want to restructure cities so they are confederations of neighborhood assemblies and have participatory budgeting, where a significant portion of the city budget goes to the neighborhood and people there decide how to allocate it for the needs in that neighborhood. We want to change the way cities are governed. I mean, the trend is toward running cities like businesses, fewer representatives, more executive power, top-down. And the people are just consumers, but in this case, they can't choose an alternative provider because the city, you know, has control of that territory. So, you know, citizen assemblies, politically, and institutions that get people engaged and get to know each other. So that all brings it back to the local level. That's where we've got to really build a civic life, a left party, alternative institutions, And that's where the real change comes from. I mean, we're in a presidential year. The Greens are running a candidate for president, mostly to get ballot lines that we can use locally. But to my mind, the biggest thing is you got to put your bucket down in one well and just work that one. And we got to do that everywhere.
Howie Hawkins, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work.
Energy. Sometimes I think I'm running out of energy. Seems like we use an awful lot for heating and lighting and driving, reading and writing and jiving. Energy, you'd think we'd be saving it up. Energy.
That was the Energy Blues by Schoolhouse Rock. And this is the Old Mover Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. KBOO has offered a Bill of the Month membership since the very beginning of the station. Now you can be a sustaining member without any of the paperwork. We here at KBOO Community Radio encourage everyone who donates to become a monthly donor. Our members that give to us monthly provide the most secure and stable funding for the station. It's easy and secure. You can set up your monthly donation through your checking account. We can also set up your membership with a debit or credit card. Monthly giving helps us cut down on the number of membership drive days we air annually. Also, monthly members are automatically entered into all of our sweepstakes drawings. So go to kboo.fm/give. to become a sustaining member online, or call us at 503-231-8032, and we thank you. Now Desiree Hellingers interviews activists with the Mosquito Fleet, an emerging water-oriented grassroots activist group that emerged out of last summer's Shell No protests. Hellingers interviewed activist members of the Mosquito Fleet outside Hoquiam City Hall during the Quinault Indian Nation's July 8th Shared Waters, Shared Values protest against the siting of fossil fuels in Grays Harbor, and then in Portland's Cathedral Park. Desert recorded on site at these actions, and there is ambient noise and a high wind, but the voices are clear.
Last week, my segment for the Old Mole focused on the July 8th Quinault Indian Nation Shared Waters, Shared Values event to resist the siting of fossil fuels in Grays Harbor, Washington. The segment featured audio from the rally in front of Hoquiam City Hall, where Quinault Tribal President Fawn Sharp, among others, spoke about the threat that fossil fuels pose to the health and well-being of the Quinault Indian Nation and the region as a whole. During the Hoquiam rally on July 8th, I met up with Curtis Dengler, an activist with the Mosquito Fleet. Dengler spoke with me about the vision for the fleet, which emerged out of last year's Shell No actions in both Washington and Oregon, which were catalyzed and coordinated by the Backbone Campaign, a Vashon Island-based NGO.
Mosquito Fleet got started for the most part. The Mosquito Fleet was an outgrowth, really, of the Shell No movement that sprung up last year to stop Shell from drilling in the Arctic Ocean. As you may remember, there were a lot of protests in Seattle and elsewhere. Symbolic protests, direct action. There were a lot of actions on the water. A lot of this was focused in Elliott Bay. The word kayaktivism started getting used. There were canoe families coming out. And people started really thinking through this idea of using watercraft as a tactic for direct action to stop fossil fuel infrastructure and to sort of use that as a niche, if you will, for climate justice activism. And so the Mosquito Fleet is basically a gang of experienced community organizers, activists, direct action activists, and everything in between, veterans who really came together during that moment of fighting Shell. And after Shell pulled out of the Arctic, you know, we really came together and decided that we wanted to keep working together, that we wanted to try to build a presence in the region and to really try to build a group that took serious the possibilities of direct action on the water. The fossil fuel industry obviously wants the Puget Sound region, the Salish Sea, to be used as essentially a fossil fuel superhighway. And you're really starting to see this building narrative around what some people call holding the thin green line, that it's really a regional battle for us to really hold this place and prevent it from becoming really just an export region for the industry. So We're really interested in ways that we can respond to climate crisis, oil spills on the water. And we're also especially interested in thinking of creative ways to use action on the water to stop projects like, for example, the terminal in Grays Harbor from being built. I should say the proposed terminal in Grays Harbor. So we have a lot of work to do. It's a very new group, but it's a great bunch. And so we're really just getting started. The goal is to have a network down the West Coast and to really get people to also take the water seriously and the skills involved in on-water activism seriously. Obviously, there are a lot of risks involved in being out there on the water. For anybody who's taken a kayak class or been out in a boat knows that there are a lot of things that can go wrong even when you're not trying to stop Arctic drilling rigs or oil terminals or what you will. A lot of our work so far has been really gearing up this group and training ourselves to get better at what we do, to share skills, people learning how to sail, how to kayak, how to rescue people out of the water, just basic water skills. But we're also obviously activists, so we're part of this building movement and starting to really build relationships in the region with different communities that are fighting back against the fossil fuel industry. Today is just one example. So we're here first and foremost to support the Quinault Nation. They have been leading the fight against the proposed crude oil terminals here in Grays Harbor area. And we are just honored to be invited to come here and support them. And so today we've done everything we can to support the actions on the water with safety boats, experienced paddlers. Tribes are very much in the lead today. You know, this is indigenous land that we're all on, and what an inspiration to see these folks standing up for themselves, their own community, defending their own territory, and asserting their sovereignty over this land and saying, no, we have a right to practice our traditional ways, we have a right to this land, to the salmon, and certainly a right to supersede any corporate interest to make a profit off of endangering all life here for the sake of burning fossil fuels overseas. So anyway, today we're here just mainly as a support role, and we're happy to do that. There are other times that we're taking a lead role and planning direct action, because the focus of Mosquito Fleet, more than anything, is direct action on the water. We don't think that our government is going to save us from the climate crisis. We certainly don't think that corporations are just going to wise up and change their mind and wake up and decide that they really don't want to destroy the planet. We see these as systemic problems, colonialism and capitalism at its root. And so we believe that the only hope that we have as human beings, frankly, is for communities to take matters into their own hands. So if that means putting our bodies in between our communities and oil tankers, for example, if it comes to that, we're willing to rise to the challenge. The whole idea of the mosquito fleet, right, this imagery of mosquitoes is a swarming of many small beings that as a whole become greater than the sum of their parts and can stop Goliath. It's a David and Goliath sort of thing. Anybody who's seen the graphic of the small fish forming a large fish to chase away the big bad boss knows what we're talking about. So I think that the mosquito fleet really is just the embodiment of that idea that of people power, of strength in numbers, of bottom-up direct action and community organizing, taken into the context on the water. Best way to support the work that we're doing for now, frankly, is to support us financially, or we're also trying to basically form an armada, if you will, of boats. So we're looking for kayaks and kayak gears, and if you have anything that you think could be of use to an on-water movement, then let us know, drop us a message. But that's really just for the short term. Like I said, because we're just getting started, we're discussing ways in which really what trying to figure out what the best way is to form this network. We still believe that we have to stand up to the fossil fuel industry through any nonviolent means we have. We don't think that we're going to solve the climate crisis or prevent the world from being destroyed by corporations merely by symbolic action. We believe that we have to take concrete action and actually put ourselves in the way of this industry. We have to force them to stop doing what they're doing, and we have to force our leaders to take action. So that's really what it's about, is communities taking matters into their own hands and not sitting around or asking elected officials to do something about it. We can do all of the above, but somebody has to get in the way. Somebody has to be the cog in the machine and
their body against the machine.
Absolutely. And so we're willing to put our bodies on the line if it comes to that.
I met up with two other Portland-based members of the Mosquito Fleet, Mary Jade Summers and Penny Dex, this past Friday in Cathedral Park. Summers witnessed firsthand the devastating effects of the tar sands oil spill in Arkansas. Her entry into activism came via the Occupy movement in New York City.
From Occupy to tar sands blockade work, and then from that I went with a few people from tar sands blockade to the Exxon oil spill, the tar sands oil spill in Arkansas, which was a spill out of the Pegasus pipeline. It took them a couple of days to actually even detect a leak. And when they did detect a leak, it was in a residential neighborhood and a suburban community, a suburban white, like, community. And there was, like, images coming out of, like, oil just pouring down, like, you know, cul-de-sacs with, like, basketball hoops in the cul-de-sac and, like, you know, brick houses with, like, concrete driveways. Like, really, like, beautiful, like, nice little neighborhood. And I was like, what do you know? Like, come to find out people are sick. Like, we're talking to people that have, like, nosebleeds happening as interviews are running. And, like, I'm live streaming this. And there's just, like, blood dripping down this woman's face from, like, chemicals she's breathing in. We had respirators and they didn't work. Like, all of us got pretty sick. I had, like, chemical poisoning and, like, chemical sensitivity for life.
Mosquito Fleet member Penny Dex also credited the Occupy movement as an important influence on her work as an organizer, and she spoke about the links between militarism, oil, and climate change.
My name is Penny Dex. I was in the Army from 2004 to 2008 as a pharmacy tech, and while I was in, I didn't really pay attention to world events, and I was just kind of there to learn my craft and go to school. But then it just, you know, my part in the war machine became really apparent after I found people who committed suicide with my pills, and I just didn't want to participate in that kind of culture anymore. And when I moved to Portland, you know, I started work with Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace, and I found a lot of satisfaction in that. But as I kept doing this work, I got more radicalized. I kept digging deeper for the truth, like, well, why are we going to war, and why do we keep having these wars of aggression and disintegration and perpetual badness? And by 24, yeah, by the time Occupy happened, I was just in a spot where I knew why things were wrong. I knew that I wanted to change it, and I needed to find that outlet that actually, like, I didn't want to hold a protest sign anymore. I didn't want to just go march in the street. I wanted to have tangible, concrete results that actually benefited the world. And then in, you know, late July, I get a call from one of our members saying that, you know, they have a mission for us. So I knew it was going to be something with environmentalists, and I knew it was going to be something interesting, but I didn't know what it was. And that action turned out to be the St. John's Bridge action. And that was just one of those life-changing moments for me where I actually got to participate in something that was tangible, that was real, that, you know, a year later stopped Shell from drilling in the Arctic. And I've been proud of that fact ever since. So Mosquito Fleet for me as a veteran is a group where I can take my skills, like, even as a pharmacy tech, I learned, like, how to manage a team, how to, you know, place the mission first, how to work well with others, and how to basically, you know, strategically set yourself up in a spot to succeed. And that's what I've been able to do with Mosquito Fleet. That's a big part of Intersection that I'm trying to push to my other veteran friends, is that the reason that we, you know, one of the big reasons we went to Iraq was for oil. Like, my friends died for cheap American oil, and we're going to keep going to war for oil until the war machine changes. And, like, the Department of Defense is the biggest user of fossil fuels in the world. And, like, even the Department of Defense says that climate change will be the biggest threat. Like, resource wars will be the next biggest threat to the entire planet. And if the Department of Defense is going to say that, then I, you know, it's just pretty much, it's very clear cut that the more we use fossil fuels, the more we're going to keep going to war. And until that I found soldiers who had overdosed on medications I'd given them, that I started asking questions like, why are you in pain all the time? And why are you, like, in constant fear? And, like, why are you having nightmares? And why do you need this to sleep? And once I started hearing the same story over and over and over again, I joined the military. I wanted to do good. I got to war. I found out war was not the answer. I came back, and I went to war, and now I'm in the Army, and now I see that it's a bad thing, and I have no outlet. I have no way. There's no recourse to right my wrongs. There's morals injury. There's survivor's guilt. You know, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma. Like, all these things happen while you're in, and there's just no way to, like, finally, like, to get any of that justice back. And, like, through Mosquito Fleet, like, I finally, like, I'm serving my country in a way that I really want to. Like, I'm fighting the war on the planet instead of the war on terror. I'm fighting the war on our resources instead of the war in Iraq. Like, I'm actually, like, doing, I took an oath to help protect against all threats foreign and domestic for the United States. And, like, this, you know, all having, you know, not having air to breathe and water to drink and soil to grow food in is kind of like one of those threats to domestic security that we should be taking very seriously. And I hope that more veterans will in the upcoming years. The Shell Now action here at St. John's Bridge.
We're sitting right here
at St. John's Bridge. Got to work at the Break Free Action up in Anacortes, where I helped support the water team and taking the beach by the Shell refinery and just, like, doing the whole, like, reaching out to workers for a just transition. That was amazing. We went to go help the Quinault Canoe families during their cry for public support, and we were happy to do so. Like, and, like, doing my anti-war work, I've done, actually, we have a Drop the Mic campaign going on with IBAW, where, once again, we're, like, trying to show all these connections between, like, Shell Oil and all these other extractive industries that are basically making a profit off the war machine. So it's just, I've been able to have a lot of intersection. And right now, like, honestly, like, it's really hard to be anti-war with everything going on. And, like, it's basically after Obama got elected, the movement kind of died in 2008. And now this is the first time in my 5 years of doing this that I've actually had people from, you know, Fight for 15 and Black Lives Matter and Idle No More and veterans groups and Right to Dream, like, everyone just comes together and, like, actually, like, if we're all angry about the same thing for once, we're all on the same team, we all are on the planet, we can't fight for a just world on a dead planet. And, like, this is the first thing that's gotten people excited in ages, and I want to keep that excitement going and keeping the movement thriving so that we can keep making these changes.
This with the Mosquito Fleet. If you're interested in learning more about the fleet, see their website at www.mosquitofleet.us. This has been Desiree Hellers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And yes, as Desiree said, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The city of Vancouver will be voting this evening at 7 p.m. on a proposal to prohibit crude oil storage, handling, and refining in the city. The hearing will be preceded by a 6 p.m. march and rally at the corner of Esther Short Park, across the street from City Hall. The ban would be a concrete step towards stopping future dangerous proposals like the Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal in Vancouver, proposals that would bring more reckless oil traffic through the Columbia River Gorge. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Now stay tuned. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia, locally produced news, views, interviews, headlines, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Dan Flores, author of Coyote America, about the long and twisted natural history of the coyote in North America and why the coyote, unlike the wolf, has beat back a century of eradication efforts. At 11, we'll hear Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is Jean Barr, author of Living the Farm's Sanctuary Life, the definitive vegan and animal-friendly lifestyle guide. And that concludes our program for today.
are happy to announce that KBOO now has 10,000 followers on Twitter. Follower number 10,000 is our employee union, CWA Local 7901. Thank you to everyone who has brought us to this point. If you haven't yet followed us, look for KBOO on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram for links to upcoming events, audio interviews, and contests to win tickets and other prizes. Thank you to all of our social media supporters.